Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Periodically on this show, we've been checking in on the use of water in Utah and the West. The running title of our series on the topic is Unquenchable. And we gave the series that title because at every turn, it seems like there's a new need for more water somewhere in our region. A new big project to move water from one place to another. The Lake Powell Pipeline, for instance, which we most recently talked about a few weeks back. Or the Bear River Diversion. Or to go to a lesser-known example, Cedar City's application for water from valleys to its west, which we'll be turning to on a future show. In any case, our thirst for water and for growth in general is something that is cause for concern as we think about what the future of this arid part of the world might look like 10, 20, or 50 years down the road and beyond. And the question to ask is, will we look back and say that we were good stewards of our resources and of the systems that sustain life here? The long view features prominently in the very specific piece of the Western water puzzle we're focusing on today. Because for the past 31 years, a battle has been waging over water that sits suspended under a vast stretch of land overlapping the Utah-Nevada border, a region we generically call the West Desert. That battle, that political and legal fight involving ranchers, tribal authorities, environmentalists, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and the city of Las Vegas, now appears to be over. But the story of that fight and how it came to its conclusion could serve as a kind of model or lesson for others involved in similar Western water fights. As you'll hear, though, that lesson isn't your typical let's all get along and through compromise everyone gets something morality tale. It isn't a lesson even about negotiating for a better seat at the table, because as any good Vegas card player can tell you, the table isn't always a fair one, and if you play their game, eventually the house always wins. No, this is the story of how an odd bedfellow's Western coalition fought off a water grab by the city of Las Vegas by refusing to compromise one iota. The setting? The high desert valleys spanning the Utah-Nevada state line, a place where vast stretches of arid soil are held together by sage and juniper, where the occasional fragmented swales of cottonwood trees look like miniatures of themselves when compared with the impossibly distant horizon, where terns and stilts, seabirds making huge treks from here to there, rise out of the purple desert floor to startle the stray coyote, pronghorn, or rancher. Those birds, by the way, are migrants drawn to dark wetlands concealed in enormous sagebrush steppes, and possibly also drawn by genetic and topological forces to a place that was once a vast sea, before the inland ocean called Lake Bonneville broke through a wall some 14,000 years ago and spilled out into history, evaporating into nearly nothing and leaving behind the Great Basin. The wind here seems almost constant. The water, less so. Since 1989, there's been a pitched battle, legal and political, over the water that lies in carbonate aquifers beneath the various sweeping valleys that run for hundreds of miles between nowhere, Utah, and nowhere else, Nevada. Here's Steve Erickson, a consultant with the nonprofit Great Basin Water Network, describing the origin of that fight.
The Southern Nevada Water Authority's project, the Groundwater Development Project, began in 1989 when the Las Vegas Water District filed applications for groundwater rights in, well, it was upwards of 800,000 acre feet per year from over a dozen valleys in Nevada. Mostly in the carbonate aquifers that underlie east central Nevada. The idea was to pump that water down to Lake Mead for use by Clark County, Las Vegas, for growth and development purposes.
With Sin City, Las Vegas, growing fast around the turn of the millennium, and with its supply of already tenuous Colorado River water not exactly secure, Vegas resource managers looked to the stores underground hundreds of miles to the city's east. The plan, more or less, stick a big straw into the Snake, Spring, Delamar, Dry Lake, and Cave valleys and suck. At the other end of the 300-mile-long siphon hose, the city that for years was booming faster than any other in the country and that had a history of beating impossible odds.
Las Vegas was growing great guns throughout the 90s and continued in the early 2000s and really didn't halt its rapid growth until the Great Recession hit in 2008, roughly. There were protests filed by citizens in the area and by county governments on both sides of the border, Utah and Nevada. But it all kind of was put on the back burner for a decade or more. But when the drought hit the Colorado River system in 2002, those applications suddenly became of greater interest to the Southern Nevada water purveyors. So the Water Authority activated the ones that they wanted to take at this time, roughly 250,000 acre feet to begin with, so lesser than the original applications. But they activated those in 2004 as a response to this intense drought that the whole region was going through. So that it was built for accommodating the growth in Las Vegas and the suburban cities surrounding Las Vegas.
Steve Erickson there says that the project was built for that growth, but actually the pipeline never really did get built, and so he means that that's what it was designed for. The water in question, though, it's something that the residents of the Great Basin weren't easily willing to let go of.
My heritage spoke up to me and said, wait a minute, your family's been using this for 10,000 years and they're going to take it away to some place that's not even in the Great Basin?
Delaine Spilsbury is a member of the Ely Shoshone tribe in eastern Nevada. The tribe's reservation is a small piece of land, just over 100 acres on the outskirts of the historic mining town of Ely. But Spilsbury's ancestors called all of the Great Basin home for thousands of years prior to European colonization. Her mother was born inside of what is now Great Basin National Park, and her father was from the Shoshone Duckworth Reservation, about 80 miles to the west. Spilsbury joined the newly formed Great Basin Water Network in the early 2000s to fight the plan because she wanted to protect a region that she says would be drastically altered if Las Vegas's groundwater pumping plan was allowed to go forward.
Everything would be changed. And since a lot of those things, like, say, a pine nut tree, which is a pinyon, those things are sacred to us because that was something that, if it wasn't for that tree, there wouldn't have been the Nua. That's what we call ourselves. And just so many things that were traditional and to us sacred would be absolutely destroyed and never to be seen again. Mm-hmm. And that was really important to me. And it just seemed just too greedy to eliminate one lifestyle for another.
Shoshone tribe member Spilsbury's fears are shared by others in the region. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints opposed the plan to pump water out of the Spring Valley in particular because the church operates a huge cattle ranch there. Missionaries are called to work on Cleveland Ranch in Nevada, about 16 miles from the Utah border. The church has title to a sizable piece of land in the Spring Valley, and the ranch's grazing rights also span thousands of acres of public lands there. The ranch serves as the church's major source of welfare beef for bishops' storehouses, which provide food to the needy. Paul Himanowski represented the ranch, and therefore the church, in a number of the legal battles that played out over Vegas's water pipeline plan.
The basic fight, I describe it as a battle between expediency and sustainability. We, the ranch, together with the other protesters like the Great Basin Water Network, argued that the Water Authority screwed up the science badly in how they were suggesting how much water was available for them to take out for this enormous project. They, on the other hand, were saying this is the way it's always been done in Nevada, and if we're going to deplete the aquifer, that's okay because that's the way we've always done it.
In one of the legal decisions that represented a major win for opponents of the plan to move water from these valleys to Las Vegas, a district judge said that if it went forward, the project would constitute the largest interbasin transfer of water in American history. 7th Judicial District Judge Robert Estes also described the area at stake as being roughly equivalent in size to all of New England, just to give a sense of scale. We'll return to how this fight played out in the courts in just a bit, but first, the central objection from all of the residents of the region involved in the fight against the project was that by pulling water out of the aquifer, the water table would drop. The ground would dry up and even collapse in places, and much of the plant life would die out. For a time, one of the entities also opposed to the project was Salt Lake County. Then-Mayor Peter Caroon was one of many who feared a deterioration in air quality along the Wasatch Front if the West Desert's plant life was eliminated, the general idea being that prevailing weather patterns would bring all of the newly loosened soil, the dust from a drained West Desert, into northern Utah. So objections were lodged from hundreds of miles away. But the fear of a barren terrain is also what motivated members of a prominent ranching family on the Utah-Nevada border to oppose Vegas's plan.
We felt like it would essentially devastate the valley. They thought there was a lot more water here than we think there is. And in our experience in farming and ranching here for the 40 or 50 years, we've had trouble finding enough water to do what we'd like to. And when we do develop water, we do see effects in different places. And to think that there was that much water and then to pump it out of the ground and take it away would have caused a lot of damage to the plants and animals in this valley and would have changed the landscape significantly. I'm Tom Baker, and I farm and ranch in Snake Valley with my two brothers, and we do it together. Our grandfather moved here in the mid-50s, and my father worked here his whole life after college at the University of Utah. And he, with respect to the water grab, he was early on in the early 2000s, was really involved in helping start the water network and worked through it, and he passed away a few years ago.
Tom's dad, Dean Baker, and another local rancher named Cecil Garland both spent decades of their lives holding back the Vegas water plan. Both men died, though, before the biggest victories in that battle were won. Again, that fight included a variety of constituents with a variety of overlapping interests, even if they weren't what you might call traditional allies. You're probably aware that in many parts of the West, ranchers and environmentalists don't get along. Rancher Tom Baker in Baker, Nevada, says that doesn't have to be the case.
If you get down to a lot of what agricultural people believe in and work toward, it's very similar to the environmentalists. They believe in taking care of the land and hopefully leave it, most of them hope to leave it better. A good example are the people we lease from that have had the land in the family for 150 years. They're obviously looking at things long term and hope to take care of it. And they hope that if they do sell it, they sell it to somebody that will take care of it. They chose not to sell or go to Southern Nevada and look at that. So a lot of farmers and ranchers have a good long-term view of the land, which is similar to the environmentalists, and they may approach it, the management, differently, but a lot of the time the goal is pretty similar.
And then sticking with odd bedfellows, historically, too, the Mormon Church and Indian tribes aren't the closest collaborators. But then there's that maxim, maybe not the most precise one for the story, given the church's involvement, but the old maxim that whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. And in this instance, a coalition came together to fight a common opponent because their shared water was on the line. For the Mormon Church, the objective was protecting their property, but also the property of their neighbors. Paul Himanowski, the lawyer who represented the church, says that the coalition just made sense.
The fact of the matter is that when you get past some of the historical rhetoric, all of the groups you've identified are people who are concerned about our way of life. They're concerned about the environment. They're concerned about preserving the natural environment. So for them to come together and work together, well, they're all reasonable people with a common goal.
For members of the Shoshone tribe, like Delane Spilsbury, they were fighting for ancestral lands, like a traditional gathering place in the Spring Valley that was also the site of massacres of Shoshone people at the hands of the military and others in the 19th century.
Well, the whole center of this water grab is Spring Valley. which is a valley that's one valley less west of Snake Valley, where the Great Basin National Park is. And that was, I learned as a child, there's a grove of trees that grow in the bottom of the valley, which is the only place in the Great Basin that occurs. And we visited there a lot, and I had learned over time that it was the scene of many massacres, and our people feel that the souls of those people that are still in the trees. My own personal experience is I can feel that, and the roots on those trees are shallow, so I knew from the very beginning that those trees would be gone maybe a couple of years after they started pumping water, because they'd just be with their sustenance.
In addition to the Shoshone, the Utah-headquartered Confederated Tribes of the Goshute Reservation also opposed the plan for potential impacts on their traditional lands. For a time, representatives from the Great Basin National Park were also involved in opposing the pipeline, though that involvement eventually became fraught because of some agreements the federal government struck with the Las Vegas Water Authority. Faraway places like Salt Lake County said, "We don't want the dust storms this project might produce." Back in 2013, Utah Governor Gary Herbert said that he wouldn't sign a water-sharing agreement with Nevada over the project, saying it wasn't the right decision for Utah. Here's Governor Herbert in an interview with me about 7 years ago after announcing that he wouldn't sign the agreement.
With or without the agreement, the objectives don't change. We don't want to have any Utah water go to Nevada or any other place outside of Utah. And we don't want to have any water rights jeopardized. The people have worked for years and proven up their water rights and their wells and their irrigation systems out there in the West Desert. We don't want to have anybody have their water rights jeopardized. And we certainly don't want to have the environment jeopardized by somebody pumping water that in fact has degradation to the environment. So with or without the agreement, those goals and objectives don't change.
The Snake Valley that overlaps the Utah border was eventually dropped from the groundwater project. But despite the ongoing opposition from various quarters, the Southern Nevada Water Authority kept pushing for the project in adjacent valleys, seeing a future need for the water. So what ultimately happened? As mentioned, 31 years of fighting since applications were first filed. A lot of that fighting happened in the courts. Over and over again, SNWA wanted to reach a kind of negotiated settlement, and over again, the coalition said no. For a time, the Vegas Water Authority resorted to buying up properties in the valleys and the water rights that came with them, in the presumed hope of eventually being able to convert those rights from agricultural to municipal uses. But in court case after court case, both state and federal cases, the water agency and the Nevada state engineer who was in favor of the project kept getting thwarted by the courts. In general, that was because questions about the science around how the monitoring of environmental impacts would occur and how decisions would be made to stop pumping if the effects became too damaging, those questions didn't get sufficiently answered, at least not for the judge deciding many of the cases. There was that, and the fact that much of the water that Las Vegas wanted to draw on had already been allocated to existing local users. A ruling this March by 7th District Judge Robert Estes, once again rejecting the plan, meant that Vegas water managers would have to appeal to the state Supreme Court, something they had done before and something that the coalition expected them to do again. But then something unusual happened. In May, the Southern Nevada Water Authority said that after 3 decades, they were dropping the plan altogether. Their rationale? It was no longer necessary. Here's the Great Basin Water Network's Steve Erickson.
Yes, the board of directors of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which consists of local governments in Clark County that receive this water from the Southern Nevada Water Authority, which acts as a wholesaler to the smaller water districts in the area. They voted on May 21st to drop the project, and they removed it from their future plans for the water for the cities in Clark County, Las Vegas in particular. They withdrew their applications for water that would required by the project. They notified the Bureau of Land Management they were no longer seeking, nor would they continue to try to resolve problems around the right-of-way. So they dropped the right-of-way, and they agreed to cease their stipulated agreements with the federal agencies like the Park Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs that they had to have in order to move forward with the project. So they basically cut bait on the entire project. And the rationale is important for the people who are listening to understand. The reason is they did conservation to such a good degree in Las Vegas and surrounding communities that the demand for the Colorado River water, for more water, dropped even as the population continued to increase. So the population increases, and yet they are using less water now than they were when they applied for it in 2004. So it's pretty remarkable. It was an aggressive program. People notice all the fountains in Las Vegas, and but all of those are recycled water in the casinos. All that water is recycled. The water goes back into Lake Mead after being treated and is considered a resource available for future use. So they get return flow credits under the compact with the other states along the Colorado River system.
So after so many legal defeats and after decades of saying this project was needed, the Southern Nevada Water Authority decided to pull the plug. Not, at least on the face of it, because of the seemingly endless opposition they were met with, but because they had found another way out of their water crisis: conservation. And it seems like all but a foregone conclusion that had this strange Western menagerie not been opposing this project, or had they decided to compromise earlier, that's not the conclusion Las Vegas would have come to. In fact, it stands to reason that this pipeline would have been built long ago. Food for thought for those of you listening predisposed to mediated solutions to all of the world's problems. So you might be wondering what the Southern Nevada Water Authority would say about the fact that they spent, as LDS church lawyer Paul Himanowski told me, millions upon millions of dollars on the project.
Because I think you'd find that the ratepayers have spent an enormous amount of money, I mean, millions many times over, on this project, and they've walked away from it.
You might be wondering why it took as long as it did for them to change course and find a different solution. I've been trying to connect with representatives from the authority, but after an initial phone call with their media staff and a number of emails, I didn't end up hearing back before my deadline, and as a result, their version of this story is sorely missing here. So we'll try to talk to them on a future show when we look at the conservation measures Vegas implemented and how other parts of the arid West might learn from the desert gambling mecca. There are still some things pending. SNWA still owns a number of ranches out in the basin, ranches with water rights that opponents are worried might eventually be converted from agricultural to other uses. There are also water speculators in the area, people who have been buying up properties and water rights with the likely aim of selling them, and presumably to entities involved in a future water grab. The Great Basin Water Network and the coalition we've been focusing on during this show says that they will remain vigilant. They want to make sure the agency withdraws all of the relevant applications, and of course they'll be waiting in case Vegas or another would-be water snatcher comes knocking. Before we wrap up, I'm going to mention one more thing. I said just a minute ago that conservation had done the trick for Las Vegas, that that's why water managers decided to pull out of the groundwater pumping plan. Well, that's not the entirety of the story. It's a big part, but not all of it. Vegas is also investigating a plan to desalinate water on the Pacific Ocean, which it would then trade for more water upstream on the Colorado River. So there's that. There's also the fact that they got a deeper straw into Lake Mead, which holds the Colorado River water that Vegas uses, as well as all of the water for a lot of downstream users. That deeper intake in the reservoir means that they'll have access to the river water even if the lake dries up to what is generally called deadpool, when water isn't even passing through the reservoir's turbines. And that will be a scary moment indeed if and when it comes. In any case, with their new intake, their third straw in the lake, Vegas can get up to the last trickle of water, but not before water managers in Washington County, Utah, try to get theirs further upstream at Lake Powell. Here's the Great Basin Water Network's Steve Erickson again.
And then, of course, what they also did is they built two additional intakes into Lake Mead. So the third straw, as it's known, is deep enough in Lake Mead that it can take water out even at about 870 feet in elevation, which is far below where it is now, which is at around 1080 in elevation. So it should, for the foreseeable future, allow for the Southern Nevada water to take water out of Lake Mead, even as it continues to shrink in size and lower in elevation due to drought and climate change. So it's an object lesson, in a sense, for those in Utah who insist that we have these great big multi-billion dollar water development projects for St. George and for the northern part of the state utilizing the Bear River. Do these things first, you know, take these other conservation and pricing mechanisms and use them before you start spending money on a river, in the case of Lake Powell in the Colorado, that might not be able to provide the water you're projecting in the future.
And a reminder that you can learn about the Lake Powell Pipeline Project and about the negotiations over the water in the Colorado River in previous episodes of this program over at the In the Hive show page. So there you have it, the story of how saying no for 31 years ended up being a successful strategy for a unique Western coalition fighting to save the water that sits, at least for the time being, under their land. There's a lot that we didn't get into on this show. For example, the fact that this wasn't the first time this bizarre amalgam of Western archetypes came together to fight. In some ways, the Great Basin Water Network was the direct descendant of the Citizens Education Project that formed to fight the MX Missile Initiative back in the early 1980s. That project would have brought a system of nuclear warheads to the West Desert. And, well, I don't have time to tell you about it. Needless to say, many of the same players involved in the coalition I featured today fought that plan too and won. Photos that I took last month of some of the people involved in this battle, as well as of the landscape itself, can be found at kcpw.org. That does it for this edition of In the Hive from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent public radio resource. A reminder that your contributions power the work that we do. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week.